financial literacy is the key to sound financial health, and Americans, they're not entirely up to speed, as researchers have found out, but we can work on growing that knowledge base because it's another edition of On Your Money here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and Kevin McKinley is with us. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin, welcome.
Hello, Kate.
Do you have a personal finance question that's been on your mind? Run it by Kevin McKinley, 800-642-1234. You can send that question via email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin, a recent survey says that Wisconsin residents are doing pretty well financially. What's this all about?
Yeah, the survey came from a website called Wallet Hub, which is a financial content site. We're going to be talking about Wallet Hub in a few weeks here. But the survey tried to measure how financially savvy certain residents of states were. And they used 23 different metrics, such things as debt as a percent of income, how you feel about your own financial literacy, your savings level, your credit scores, etc. And then they ranked several of these states overall and then also broke them down into several different subcategories.
And how did Wisconsin fare?
We did very well, Kate, and I'm going to take all the credit for this on Your Money.
Of course, right.
Wisconsin ranked 7th overall, and we were highest, number 1 in financial literacy. We were number 6th in debt as a relation to our spending, and number 17th in our credit scores, and 20th for how much we keep in our savings account.
And so what about other states? How did they do?
The best overall was Massachusetts. The lowest scoring state, according to these metrics, was Mississippi. Minnesota was 4th. Iowa was 11th. Michigan was 19th. And Illinois brought up the rear in the Midwestern states at 27th.
So what can listeners take away from these results?
Well, pat yourselves on the back if you were participating in this survey. Good job. And information, as you mentioned, in literacy is very important to have when you're trying to become financially independent and make yourself secure. But what is even more important is action and discipline. And that's why I really like the surveys, because they didn't just say, you know, answer a bunch of questions about do bonds rise or fall when interest rates rise or fall. They actually had things where they wanted to know about how people treated debt, how they dealt with it in terms of their income, what kind of credit score they had. And it's much more important to take solid actions and have discipline about your spending and saving and investing and paying off debt than it is actually to have just information, because information is good to have, but it doesn't do any good for you if you don't actually act on it. So if you want some simple steps, things you can do right now, here's what works for people. First of all, know what you spend. If you're having trouble saving money, the first thing you have to do is find out where every single penny is going, and then you can hopefully figure out what you can cut. And if you can't find anything else to cut, you're still underneath your spending based on your income, you may have to earn more. We had a great call last week from a caller who said he's taking a part-time job to help pay off his student loans. And again, people don't realize, especially younger people, how many people who seem to be successful and wealthy and well-established now started out by working extra hours, extra jobs, to try to get more money so that they could become more financially secure. Any extra money that you get in above and beyond your basic expenses, split it between paying off debt and savings. So if you get $100 extra in, use $50 to pay down debt, not student loans or your mortgage or car loans, but credit card debt, anything over 10% interest. And finally, save about 10% a year of your income. That should be your goal. If you're making $40,000 per year, you should at least be trying to put aside $4,000 of that into some kind of savings account or retirement plan.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. So with that, do you have a money question that's on your mind? Kevin McKinley is your sounding board at 800-642-1234. Send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to David in Sabin. Hi, David.
Hello. I'm a 75-year-old retired person, and I'm wondering what percentage of my savings should be in cash or CDs or that sort of thing, and what percentage should be in stocks or mutual funds?
Yeah, David, that's the eternal question when it comes to someone who does this for a living, of what percentage of certain assets should be in certain investments. And it's difficult to diagnose that over the radio. I will say this, though. One of the things that I like to predicate your asset allocation on is how much growth do you actually need to meet your desired spending level over the rest of your life? And many times when people come to me in their 60s or late 50s or early 70s and say, how much should I have in cash or CDs or stocks? We figure out through analysis that they really have enough money to last them through their lifetime and beyond. And so then the question becomes is how much reward do you want to reach for and therefore incur a much greater amount of risk to achieve that reward? And it's a hard it's a hard decision to make in that it's a good problem to have, but it's a hard decision to make because what you're really doing is it's kind of like driving home from the supermarket, let's say, and you're three blocks away from home and you see your house and you're in a 25-mile-an-hour zone and you realize there's no cops around, there doesn't seem to be any pedestrians, so you're just going to speed 75 miles an hour down your street. Now, that may get you there a few seconds sooner, but are those few seconds really worth the extra amount of risk that you took that you would get in a crash or you would hit a child trying to cross the street or you would get a speeding ticket? And so that's a question. Whenever I analyze asset allocation, I always start with how much more growth do you need? And so usually people who are older generally are in pretty good shape. And so I'd probably advise you, if I can advise you, is to err on the side of caution, especially at this juncture in the world when we've had a tremendous run-up in the bull market over the last 9 years almost now. Mm. And so, try to err on the side of caution.
Well, David, thanks for calling in. Kevin, a listener named Alicia writes, love the show. My husband and I are both 30. We have some retirement savings and are looking at ways to put away money for short-term savings plans. Am I able to have more than one Roth IRA account, one through work and another through Charles Schwab or similar investment? If so, what do you think of this plan to create a savings account for short-term savings, such as a house, a car, or even putting away for my child's future?
Well, as you know, Kate, first of all, we took this question simply because it's a good question, and Alicia included false praise in it. So make sure you always include false praise in any questions whatsoever. The Roth 401k and the Roth IRA, yes, you actually can contribute to both of those. There's no income limits on people who can contribute to a Roth 401k. There are income limits to who can contribute to a Roth IRA, but for married couples filing jointly, they're up around $185,000 or $190,000 of adjusted gross income. So hopefully, Alicia and her husband can meet those limits. Now, the other question is, should they contribute to it? And if their combined income, gross income, is over $100,000 or $50,000 for single filers, they might be better off doing pre-tax contributions to the regular 401k to get under the 15% federal income tax bracket and then switch either to doing the Roth 401k or just contributing to a Roth IRA.
Why the regular 401k instead of the Roth 401k?
It's really about, are you going to be taxed at a higher bracket on that money now or when you pull it back out in retirement? Mm-hmm. And again, if you have less than $50,000 of gross income as a single filer or $100,000 for married couples filing jointly, you're probably going to be in the 15% federal income tax bracket, definitely no more than that. So your taxes are generally going to be the same in retirement as they are right now on that money. If it's anything higher than that $50,000 to $100,000 level, you're probably going to be in the 25% federal income tax bracket, and most retirees are at a bracket at lower than that rate. So you're better to get the break now by using a regular 401k rather than the Roth 401k, and then paying taxes just at a lower rate down the road. Now, there is one trick, and we did talk about this a few months ago. There was a study that tried to figure out where people ended up better off if they use the Roth 401k and the regular 401k, and it's kind of inside baseball. But what they found is that people actually did better with the Roth 401k, not because of that tax bracket difference, but because when you make contributions to a Roth 401k, you don't get a tax break on your earnings, so you end up paying the taxes on it right now, whereas people who do get a tax break on their regular 401k or 403b deposit end up spending that money. They don't save that extra taxes that they save and additionally into it. So they found out that you actually end up more with that, but it's something that you can control. It's not the vehicles in and of themselves.
So what about this idea of using the Roth IRA for short-term savings goals?
I love it. I think it's a fantastic idea. We talked about it here before, but you don't get any tax break on the contributions, although if you're in a very low income bracket, you may get a small savers credit on contributions to Roth IRAs. It might be a few hundred dollars, definitely helps out. But the earnings on the Roth IRA in the future are sheltered from taxation, but the contributions to that Roth IRA can always be withdrawn at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. The only thing I would caution Alicia and her husband is to say if you are investing it for a shorter term goal, you probably want to invest it more conservatively. You may give up on some potential yield, but you also don't want to have a big crash in the stock market and have that damage the value of your investment right when you need it.
You're listening to On Your Money. Kevin McKinley stays with us. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. We'll be back to tackle more of your personal finance questions in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Wisconsinites are above average when it comes to money smarts, but there's always room to grow, and that's why there's another edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with your personal finance question at 800-642-1234. Send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Marianne in Superior. Hi, Marianne.
Good morning. I'm a longtime listener of On Your Money, and I'm an old critter, but I only take my advice from Kevin McKinley.
Thank you very much, Marianne. And
old
people,
critter.
This is why we're taking Marianne's call.
But the reason that I'm calling, after I kick the proverbial bucket, I'm wondering in regards to CDs and bank accounts, if I am better to, my best option is to have a beneficiary on the accounts or a co-owner, especially regarding tax implications.
Yeah, Marianne, that's a great question, and I will tell you this, and it's I can tell by your acuity you probably have a very long life expectancy, but I can also say it because people who plan for their own demise in the way that you have, and I've gone down to these details, I generally believe that it's life-affirming and that you never die. And I've done this now. This is my 30th year as a financial advisor. And I had clients who 25 years ago said, well, I can't take out a 12-month CD. I can only take out a 6-month because I'm 76 years old and I don't want to lock up the money for 12 months. And those people are still alive today. The people who don't plan for their own demise, don't do any estate planning. Those people have passed away in some cases, and it's purely anecdotal, but I believe that it's a good idea, and it's good for your life expectancy. And, quite frankly, it's really other than leaving people money, it's the nicest thing you can do for them is leave them an estate that can easily be settled. So I appreciate the motivation behind your question. In my opinion, for CDs, it's better off to have a beneficiary rather than a co-owner, because once you make any kind of investment co-owned by someone else, they co-own it. That means it's partially their money, and they can do what they want with that portion, and they may be completely trustworthy and honest and decent, but other people in their lives may not be, and they may put pressure on them to get access to that money, or they may make a mistake, get sued, and that asset that they now co-own can become part of a kind of a settlement, or they can get a divorce. So it's not a good idea unless you actually want to give money to that person to put them on as a co-owner of the account. So the beneficiary is the way to go. And generally, banks can help you set up those accounts, Marianne, as a way to avoid probate, meaning all the person has to do is come in with a death certificate and they can say, nope, this skips the will, the probate process, and go directly to that person rather than having to go through it. So good for you, and I would much rather have you use the beneficiary rather than a co-owner.
Marianne, thanks for calling in. Let's go to Joe now in Green Bay. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I was wondering, my mother passed away this past January, and then she left me an inherited IRA. I was wondering, when it comes to the RMD, is it for the tax year 2017, is the RMD based upon her age or is it based upon my age?
It's based on any calculation for the inherited IRA, Joe, is based on the beneficiary's age, and so there's a calculator I'll put up for you that that you can use. But it is for people out there in this situation, there is a wrinkle to this that can the beneficiary's age on December 31st of the owner's death and of the distribution year can affect it. So I'll put a calculator for you up later today, Joe, at onyourmoney.com. It's a good calculator, and you can just punch in the information. It'll tell you exactly what you need to take out of it, okay?
And explain RMD, required minimum distribution, Kevin.
Required minimum distributions. Thank you for asking, Kate. I'm glad you asked. The required minimum distributions are what the IRS says that people who own an IRA have to take out generally once they pass the age of 70 and a half, or people who inherit an IRA, if it's not a spouse, they have to take a certain amount out based on their age every single year. And the reason the IRS does that is because they just want to get their taxes from that sooner or later. And if there were no RMDs on any investments at all, that money could keep rolling over tax-free, tax-free, tax-free. And it's really great for the people who own it, but it doesn't do much for the IRS and replenishing the coffers at the Treasury. And so they need to get the taxes from that sooner or later.
Joe, thanks for calling in. Let's go to Angela now in Fish Creek. Hi, Angela.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Kevin, I am wondering, my husband and I have some debt. We've got student loans. He has a very, very low interest rate, so we do minimum payments on his. I have a higher interest rate. I graduated a couple years earlier, and I owe about $3,000 on that. And then we have a car loan, which, of course, is a mandated payment amount. And then we have a higher credit card debt, which doesn't have a high interest rate. It's about 8.99. But I'm curious, my husband gets bonuses at work. And when we get these bonuses, we're kind of wondering what the best way is to pay off our debt. With the car having that set payment, it'd be nice to pay that off. But is it worth it? That's also a lower interest rate. I think it's about 2% or 2.99%. Something like that. So I'm curious what the best places are to start paying down that debt to get things paid off.
Yeah, the first thing I'd want you to do, Angela, is get at least 3 months' worth of living expenses set aside from any bonus, extra income, any savings you can have. And that does two things. First of all, it forces you to figure out what you're actually spending every single month, and then you may be able to figure out some things you can cut. And it also, 3 months is generally the time that most people in most middle-income jobs are out of a job until they get a new one. So 3 months is a good rule of thumb as a base amount to have aside for any emergency, because that can cover you if you want. One of or both of you should lose your jobs. So get 3 months worth of living expenses set aside. Then after that, you definitely want to attack that credit card debt first before you make the the payment on the car loan because the interest rate, first of all, is so much higher. Second of all, credit card debt generally hurts your credit score more than the debt on the car because the debt on the car is a securitized loan, meaning that there's an asset underneath there that if you don't pay the loan, the creditors can take, and therefore it's not as dangerous of a loan to have out as a credit card in the eyes of the people who may lend you money in the future. And lowering your credit or raising your credit score by paying off the credit card not only is valuable because it saves you interest, but by boosting your credit score, that can save you money on what you're paying on your auto's insurance, on your homeowner's insurance, and all the different kinds of areas that you may need a boost on that you don't even know. And again, we'll be talking about that in a few weeks, but I would definitely attack the credit card first. And especially if you know that if you do have an emergency in the future, it's relatively easy to charge that credit card back up again and put the emergency expenditure on the credit card. Whereas with a car, if you pay the car off, then you have to go back to the bank or credit union and say, okay, can I get a new loan on this? And all the car is depreciated now, so we can't get as good a loan. And by definition, if you need money, it's tougher to get a loan at that time. But if you do need money and you have the credit card open, it's a lot easier to just put it on the plastic. Now, the only time I would say to not pay off the credit card is if you are self-aware to say, Kevin, if we pay that credit card off, we'll charge it back up on something that we will regret, and we'll be in worse shape then than we are now. That's the only way I would say not to pay the credit card off. Otherwise, pay the credit card off first before making any payments. And Angela, I would say don't do anything with the car loan. Just make the minimum payments on it until it's paid off.
Angela, thanks for calling in with that priority type question on a bonus. And you can call in with your personal finance question at 800-642-1234. Go to financial planner Kevin McKinley is with us. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Kathy now in Madison. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Kevin, we have two college students, and we are in the process of passing on your infinite wisdom to them, so we certainly appreciate it. Thank you.
I'll keep providing it infinitely.
Excellent. That's what I was hoping for. And the question that I've got relates to them, actually. So after the Equifax mess, I finally got around to arranging to freeze credit scores for us, or, you know, freeze credit reports, I mean. And I had no trouble doing that for me and for my husband. At any of the credit bureaus, it would not allow us to freeze credit reports for either of our college students, and basically said they were unable to do it based on the information that we'd entered. They each have they each hold credit cards, but don't otherwise have any loans or anything like that, and I'm just wondering what's up with that.
Did you try to do it yourself, or did the kids try to do it and they were unable to do it?
We were doing it ourselves as a group thing from our home computer.
Okay, right. Yeah, that's what I'd recommend. And you, the kids are over 18, right?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, they should definitely freeze their credit report, and they should be able to do it. Did you just get something spit back to you from the screen that said, "Sorry, we can't do this for you"?
Yeah, basically. From both Experian and TransUnion, and Equifax didn't seem to want to freeze anyone's at all.
Oh, yeah, and this is a fluid situation. After the Equifax breach, a lot more people, 143 million plus Americans, were affected by this, and everybody else is still worried about it, and rightfully so. It's something we should be concerned about. In fact, we're going to have a special show on this in the first week in December, and we're going to have some information for you if you're concerned about this, and you can hang on for another 6 weeks or so. We'll have the information for you. But in this time, what I would do, Kathy, is I would actually call each bureau and try to do it in the morning. That's when they're less busy, and try to get a hold of them, explain your problem to them. And many of these bureaus are changing their procedures on almost a day-to-day basis, it seems. And I've had a lot of different responses from people who have these same kinds of questions about freezing their credit score. And some people said, well, I called and I got through right away and I froze it. Or other people said, I just had an icon on the website. I just click it and it's done. It's frozen. Other people said, I haven't been able to do anything and I can't get anybody on hold. Mm-hmm. And so you have to keep trying for it. But I recommend that you do it. It is the best way to actually prevent against identity theft, and especially in the sense of someone opening up a credit card in your or your children's names and borrowing money, and then you have to sort out the mess afterwards. You never have to pay the money off if you didn't actually borrow it, but you do have to sort out the mess. And then even when the mess is sorted out, it can still last for years afterwards and come back to haunt you with more hassle. So I recommend you do it, fight through it, get it frozen. Once it's frozen, you're pretty much done with it until they actually go to borrow money again.
Kathy, thanks for that question. Families with students going to college next fall can begin filing for financial aid right now, and you may want to do so sooner rather than later. Why is that, Kevin?
Well, this is regarding the FAFSA, the Federal Application, Free Application for Federal Student Aid, F-A-F-S-A. It used to be that if you had a kid going to college in the fall, January 1st of that particular calendar year was the first time you could file for the FAFSA. Now it's October 1st, so you may have a kid going to school in the fall of 2018, and now would be the first time that you can actually fill out the FAFSA for that. The deadline for the 2018 isn't actually, it's kind of weird, it's not till June 30th of 2019, so you can still kind of retroactively apply for financial aid by filling out the FAFSA. So you don't have to file it now, but the sooner you do it, the better, because some of the financial aid that some schools award is first come, first served, and the results you get once you fill out the FAFSA will give you a better idea of what you might need to come up with otherwise, and give you a lot more time to scramble around to meet the financing need rather than, sitting there at the bursar's office on September 3rd counting out your jar of pennies to make sure that your kid can actually enroll in classes.
So what do families need to know about financial aid for higher education?
For most families, the majority of the financial aid that they are going to be awarded will come from loans, which generally have to be repaid. You may have a child who's a very good student, but for most schools, very good does not equal special, and it's not enough to get a lot of free extra money on an academic basis alone. Even some of the grants and scholarships that many, especially private schools, offer, you might still end up paying more than what you would otherwise get from just an in-state school that gives you no special financial aid at all. And it's very difficult to have your cake and eat it too. A lot of people who have kids who are going to be enrolling in college in the next year to say, okay, what are the tricks I need to change my situation around to qualify for more aid? And basically, if you have income and you have assets, generally you don't qualify for too much in the way of need-based financial aid.
But that said, how can families ensure that they qualify for as much need-based aid as possible?
Well, one of the kind of the weird quirks of the way that the system works is if you have children, and especially if they're younger than 15 or 16, you want to save for your own retirement as much as you can right now. And for a couple of reasons. First of all, assets that you save for your own retirement aren't accounted in the expected family contribution formula. That's the formula that's used to determine how much you as a family have to kick in. And usually they don't count retirement assets in that formula. And the second thing is if you're trying to save for retirement while your kid's in college and you're applying for financial aid, let's say you're setting aside $10,000 a year in your 401k. The school, the financial aid formula, looks at that $10,000 and says, well, you could do anything with that, including help pay for your kid's college. So we're going to include that income in the expected family contribution because it's part of money that you have discretion over. So you want to save before you for retirement, before the kids actually go to school, and then you have money that not only can be used to help pay for college, but it's not going to jeopardize your financial security because you've already saved so much beforehand. You can use Roth IRAs to save any extra money for it. Again, the earnings are sheltered from taxation. The asset doesn't go into the expected family contribution. But again, you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want to pay for college. In the future, though, once you do pull money out of a Roth IRA, that income can then go back into the expected family contribution, which can hurt your need-based aid awards, but it won't be by a significant amount.
So what if the only aid awarded is in the form of loans?
Well, usually the aid that most families qualify for are federal student loans, direct loans, and there's two kinds of them, the subsidized and the unsubsidized. The subsidized one is need-based, and it has easier repayment terms, and it's determined by the school whether or not you get it and how much. But just about everybody will qualify for the unsubsidized loan. And no matter which one you get, I think you should take it. And the reason being is it's a very low interest cost, 4.45%. And that interest can be tax deductible depending on your situation. And the reason you take the loan now rather than later is that down the road, your kids might go to, you know, they might be in their freshman year now, but might be in their senior year in 3 years. And there might not be that kind of aid available, or it might not be as offered at attractive terms. Or you might not be able to have the cash to pay them off because to pay for college because you have other need for that money. Or they might go on to grad school or get an MBA or whatever. And it's better to have the loan and pay a little bit of interest in that, again, a very low dollar amount, than it is to have no loan but no money to not only pay for future education expenses but also any other emergencies that you or your kid may go through. So definitely take the direct federal student loans, and if the kid gets out of school and there's just so much money around you don't even know what to do with it, you can always pay it off. But these federal student loans are the ones that, as of now, can be helped by the income-based repayment plans, if you want, where you can slow down the amount of money that you need to pay every month and still stay current with them. And then there are several kinds of programs that will actually pay off those student loans if your kids choose certain jobs or certain other occupations in different areas.
Let's take another call now. Amanda in Madison. Go ahead, Amanda.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is priority related as well, just like Angela a few minutes before. So I was working with a company, and I'm fortunate enough to be accumulating a pension over the last couple years. But we're going through a buyout, and so the pension will no longer continue starting in January. And at the end of this year, we are going to be fully vested in our pension and have the chance to either cash it out or roll it over into the 401k. And so the company offered a 401 and the pension. And so I'm young. I have a lot of student loan debt. I also have credit card debt from just going through my master's degree. So I'm just wondering, is it better to take it out, pay off my debt, or just to roll it over into the 401k?
Right. It's congratulations, Amanda. That's a good place to be and a good question to ask. The issue is really what's the cost of the debt versus the cost of paying the taxes on it and pulling it out. Now, if you pull it out, are you going to have to not only pay taxes on the balance, but also like a 10% penalty on it as well?
You know, that I'm not sure.
Okay. I'd check on that because that could be the case.
Okay.
And even then, what's the credit card interest rate debt? Do you know what that is?
They're retail cards. They're pretty high.
Okay, so they're in the 15-25% range, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Some people look at that and say, well, you're only in the 15% tax bracket, and so if you pull it out, you're going to have to pay 15% on it, so just leave it in there and pay the interest. But the interest lasts forever until you pay the debt off. So you're much better off taking the one-time hit on that and paying the taxes and the penalties just to get those paid off. Because, again, not only do you save money on the interest, but you boost your credit score up so that you can save money on future borrowing, and you might be able to refinance any other loans you have at a lower interest rate because your credit score will be better. And then you can start saving more money into the 401k because you won't have the payments to those debts anymore. So without knowing the exact numbers for it, I would tell you actually to cash it out, pay especially the high interest rate, all the department store credit cards or whatever they are, pay those off. Anything over 10%, it's worth it to pay it off and be done with it. Just make sure that you don't charge them back up again, and then use the money that you were previously using to make payments on those cards, Amanda. Use that to start contributing to that new 401k.
Well, Amanda, thanks so much for calling in with that question. You're listening to On Your Money, and financial planner Kevin McKinley stays with us to address your financial questions. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. We'll be back shortly with more personal finance aha moments right here on the Ideas Network.
shop around.
It's another installment of On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is with us, and Kevin is taking your personal finance questions. Kevin is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. What is your personal finance question for Kevin? Join in. Send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Kevin, it's the beginning of the fall television season, so we're going to spend some time discussing how to spend less and get more TV to watch. So first off, how much TV are we watching these days?
Well, Kate, we're watching more than ever, but we're just not watching it from the traditional sources like we were. Still, of the homes that do have cable or dish, cable has about 60% of homes, dish is about 40%, and the average monthly cost, cable is about $103 per month, and the dish is a little less than that. Now, it depends, of course, if you add on a lot of extra features, a lot of the premium channels on that. We happen to do that. We don't spend a lot of money on entertainment, going out to movies or anything like that, but we do spend a lot on cable, and I just checked, and I think our cable bill is just a shade shy of our mortgage payment, so I'm guilty of spending a lot of money on that. Of course, that maybe says more about my mortgage payment than it does about the cable bill, but still, we spend a lot of money on that, and it can be over $1,000 to $2,000 per month for most family, or per year rather, for most families.
Okay.
And it's never been a better time to learn how to cut your costs and what you spend on cable, on dish, and getting your TV fix.
Is there clearly a better option between cable and satellite?
For each person, yes, but it depends on your situation. Cable generally is more reliable and usually has a higher speed, a better transmission, so you're less likely to get interruptions in the broadcast. But there are higher installation costs, especially if you have multiple sets and you need the little boxes in different rooms throughout the house. The dish usually has slightly lower prices. Generally, they have a much better DVR system. It's easier to access. They have more space on it, and you can record more shows at once than you can with cable. But the weather can affect the transmission for it. The equipment fees per month can be higher, and with most of these dish and satellite services, you have to sign a contract, and thankfully many cable companies now don't require you to sign a contract. But no matter which one you have, you can actually use the other one in exploring the cost to cut the cost on what you're currently paying.
So you can leverage that. Where should we start this process?
Call your current provider up and just say, you know what, I am thinking about my expenses and I would like to cut what I spend on getting TV every single month. Look at my bill and see what you can do for me to reduce the cost. Are there packages that I'm not aware of that could give me more services or more programming and content for what I'm currently paying? And if there are, I'd be interested in hearing about those. The only thing I'd say of this is be careful, again, about entering into any long-term contracts, because no matter how good the deal is right now, chances are a year or two from now it's going to be even more competitive, and you don't want to be locked into something that's going to be costing you more money than you could otherwise pay if you weren't locked into that contract.
Okay, but what if that phone call doesn't get you anywhere?
Then you shop around. You call if you have dish, you call cable. If you have cable, you call dish, and you tell them, I'm shopping around, and I'm thinking about switching providers here, and I need to know what you can do for me versus what I'm currently getting. And then once you get that information, go back to the original supplier and say, here's what I've been told by your competitor. What can you do for me to keep me from switching? And that leverage is really the only thing that you have to get the bill lowered at this particular point if they haven't been able to lower it yet. So if you don't get any headway and you just find that there's still more than you want to pay, go back to the very basic subscription amount for either dish or for cable. It might be $29 a month, might be $49 a month, but just go back to those basic channels and then use it for a while and see if you notice the difference. And if you don't, then great, you've already saved yourself some money. And if you find that, no, it's still too much, I'm not getting what it's worth it to pay for me, you can go in another direction.
And what's that other direction?
Cutting the cord completely, getting rid of cable, getting rid of dish, and going with over-the-air broadcast, over the web, or on demand. So in the future show, we're going to talk about how to cut the cord, join the trend, and save yourself a ton of money in the process.
Let's take another call now. Greg in Spring Valley, Minnesota joins us. Hi, Greg.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Good. I got a 19-year-old sister that is super good with money. and she wants to buy a house in like 2 years. How would we go about getting her credit built up for that? She has no credit so far.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Greg, is she has a job, I would assume?
Yes, she's got a job. She pays everything in cash. Right now she's got like $7,000 in savings, and what we were thinking is getting a car loan, but we don't know how much for, what would be optimum, because she'd like to buy straight out in cash, but if she's buying, might as well establish credit. And the other thing is that with the house, we're looking from $40,000 to $80,000 range, you know, nothing super, one or two rooms.
A starter house?
Yeah.
Yeah, good for her. That's great. And I know, Greg, I know a lot of people. She probably doesn't make a ton of money, right?
Nope.
No, but I know a lot of people like her who 20 or 30 or 50 years ago didn't make a ton of money but did start very early on focusing on things like buying a very reasonable house, establishing good credit, paying off debt, and saving everything and be very conscious of what you spend. And those people have become very financially independent despite not making, you know, six figures a year. And I know other people who've made six figures a year who don't have any of that in their 40s, 50s, or 60s. And it's because they just didn't adopt the attitude that you and your sister have. So good for both of you. What I would do is I would have her go to a bank and a credit union, and I would have her tell them what you've told me, that exactly what she's doing, that they want her as a customer. They want her to borrow money from them, and then they want her to pay it back. And so they're going to be very interested in getting her a car loan, especially if she has decent credit. And that's a good place to start because the interest rate is very low. She can pay it off whenever she wants, generally with no penalty at all. And again, it's a securitized loan. So she's more likely to get a loan for a vehicle if she has good credit than she is to get, say, a big credit card or a consumer loan for it, because the bank or credit union knows that if she doesn't pay the loan, they can take the car back and they can at least get some kind of asset for the money that they've lent to her. So start with the car loan. I think that's a really good idea. And then have her just keep saving her money as she has. And then she can tell them and say, I'm interested in buying a house in 2 years. What do I need to do between now and then to make sure that I can still get a loan? And they can't guarantee that they will, because their regulations in the world can change over 2 years' time. It may be harder to get a loan then than it is now. And no matter what she does, she may not get one at that point. But at least it will be good to know that she's doing everything she possibly can to make sure that she is in the perfect shape to get approved for that and get the loan. But actually, and a lot of people would say, well, why wouldn't you just pay cash for the car and then not have that extra debt? Your credit score is in part predicated on what kind of customer you will be for the lender. And people who pay cash for everything generally don't have credit scores that are as high as those who have borrowed some money in the past or have some debt outstanding, because the people who have borrowed money pay a little bit of interest and then they become a better customer for the lender than someone who just pays cash for everything.
Well, Greg, good luck, and thanks so much for calling in with that question. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, there's still time for you, 800-642-1234. Send your question to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Carol now in Racine. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Kate. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
You're doing such a wonderful job following up Joy. Who
oh,
is
thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Carol, are Kevin. You Kate's mother? Or?
And Kevin, you are just the best financial guru on the planet, I
wow.
swear to God.
We have the rest of the show for you, Carol.
Covered
so
all your bases, Carol.
Right.
You covered them all. Go ahead.
So I'm laying in bed last night playing my little game and falling asleep, and this offer pops up for this app, which sounds very interesting because I just turned 62 and I'm retiring at the end of the year, and I'm kind of nervous about it, about giving up my good income from my job. But it's called Acorn, and I had never heard of it before, but it sounded very attractive for being able to round up all my purchases to the nearest dollar and to put that in an investment account. But as I paged through and started entering all the information, it wanted my Social Security number and, I mean, everything but my shoe size, which made me a little nervous. Mm-hmm. So what can you tell me about that app, Kevin, please?
Yeah, I appreciate your question, Carol, and I like the fact that you are willing to tell us what you were doing in bed last night, but you're not willing to give your Social Security out to this. So I appreciate the trust, and it's just us. It's you, me, and Kate here talking about this, so you're in a safe space to share this information. It's legitimate. What happens is you spend money, and the service, when you run it through Acorns, it's acorns.com, automatically rounds up your purchases. So if you spend $28.14 on it, they take 86 cents, and they put it into an investment account for you, and then you can use that extra money you've accumulated to invest in various places. They have some commercial partners where if you buy things through these partners, they may bump it up a little bit more. You get it's kind of like getting cash back by using a certain credit card for it. It's definitely legitimate. I wouldn't be concerned about it. It's not something that you're going to get rich off of. But for anybody who needs to start investing and likes to do it conveniently without sitting down to think about it, and doesn't have a ton of money to get started with, may only have a few hundred or a few thousand dollars, I think it's a perfectly good thing to try out. Worst case scenario, you're going to pay a little bit extra in expenses, nothing significant that's going to be damaging, and you're going to get some exposure to it. And if you don't like it, it's relatively easy to get out of the system for it. So I'd encourage you to try it out and see what you think.
Carol, thanks so much for calling in. Appreciate it. Let's go to Alexander in Milwaukee. Hi, Alexander.
Oh, hello. Well, thanks for taking my call today. Basically, my question is, I spent the last 8 years in college going to undergrad and then law school, and my credit score now is in the toilet, but I just started working, and I have a second job, and I have some disposable money for the first time in a long time. And I'm wondering, what are some of the best options I can do to start building my credit score back up quickly so that I can look at things like getting an auto loan and whatnot?
Right. Alexander, let me ask you this. Are you working as an attorney and then you have a part-time job as well?
Yes.
Fantastic. I am impressed as heck by that, because I just really appreciate that. Again, I don't know if you heard the earlier part of the show, but I just really admire people who say, I understand why I'm in this situation, I understand how I got there, and hopefully the sacrifice I made in terms of my time and in terms of my money and in terms of taking on this debt will be worth it. But in the meantime, I'm not going to sit and complain about it. I'm going to do something about it by going out, trying to sacrifice whatever little extra time I have to make more money to pay this off. So I'm so glad you called, and I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing. Here's what I would suggest. Spend a little bit of money by going to a website like MyFICO. This is MyFICO.com. And it costs about $20 to get your credit score from one bureau and $60 to get it for all three bureaus. They make it sound like it's a really good deal to get the all three, but it's really just three times what you're paying for one bureau. But anyway, get it for one bureau. And then they have a simulator in there that allows you to see that if you pay off, like if you send $1,000 to this particular credit card, what the potential effect will be on your credit score. So you can figure out whether it's worth it to you, Alexander, to take all of your savings and put it on your credit card debt, or if it's you should just kind of pay it off slower. And I'd still rather have you pay it off more slowly. It takes a while to build up the credit score, and just paying it off immediately doesn't even boost it up, because the credit score kind of wonders, well, is this a one-time payoff and he's just going to charge it up again, or is this a long-time habit? So the longer that you leave it at a certain level, the better off your score will be. But tinker around with this MyFICO.com, see what you think about it, and it's worth a $20 investment so that you can see how much not only you'll save in interest, but also how you might be able to boost your credit score as quickly as possible.
Alexander, good luck, and congrats from Kevin on your side hustle. Kevin, what is the website of the week?
It's one of our favorite websites. It's consumerfinance.gov. That's the Consumer Finance and Protection Bureau. But they have a unique thing going up right now, and they've done this before. It's actually an email course where the course is called Pay Off Your Debt and Get Your Finances in Shape. And they'll send you regular updates and courses and information on how to pay off debt periodically, so you can get it in your email box. It's free. It's the government website. They're not going to try to sell you anything for it. But again, it's consumerfinance.gov, and we'll have the longer string on how to sign up for the email course at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. This hour was produced by Bill Martins with technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.